CliffCentral.com.
All right, we got so much to talk about this morning, but one of the things that we want to do is talk about obesity. It's World Obesity Day today. More than 1 billion people around the world are now suffering from obesity, with the number having more than quadrupled since 1990. According to a study released by the Lancet Medical Journal, the epidemic is particularly hitting poorer countries. The rate is growing among children and adolescents faster than adults, according to the study carried out by the World Health Organization. There's a lot to unpack in that brief introduction, and to help us do it, we're joined by Dr. Fatima Patel. Again, how are you, Doc?
I'm fine. How are you, Gareth?
Nice to see you. Nice to see you. Very good. You were such a hit last time. They want you back. Love having you here. And also today, we're joined by Dr. Sandy Bruder, who is a well-respected endocrinologist. He's based at Life Four Ways Hospital and speaks locally and internationally on endocrinology and philosophy. Dr. Bruder's also authored and co-authored in local and international journals on topics like the ones we're going to talk about today, diabetes, also philosophy and medicine, and of course, obesity. So, Doc, nice to have you here too. Thank you.
Thanks, Gareth.
How are you?
Well, yourself.
Excellent. Excellent. I'm so relieved that both of them came in and neither of them are fat, because I wouldn't know how to do it.
It's always so awkward, hey?
So awkward when you're talking about fat and there's like fat people right there. But we do have to talk about this, because as much as I make fun of, and I am made fun of, because I also looked in the mirror this morning and thought, I have no room to
criticize. You've lost 5 kgs this year already.
I have, but I still am not happy. And I don't have body dysmorphia, so don't worry about that. But I do think there are a lot of people who are suffering in a very real way every day because of this. And there's a huge difference. You actually told me this, Dr. Fatima, the other day. You said the big difference between the people who are really, really obese, they've gone like beyond a certain point where it's just a weight loss thing and, you know, eat less, run more, which you, I know you agree with my diet there. But they're people who are really, really struggling. So I'm glad to have two people here who can really help us understand this too. So where do we begin? Let's talk a little bit about what obesity is, because I've heard that there's a big difference between overweight and obese, and then there's a difference between obese and morbidly obese, if we're even allowed to use that term. So Dr. Sandeep, do you want to take us through the definitions just so that we can make sure we're on the same page?
Yeah, sure, Gareth. Look, things exist in a spectrum, and we categorize things in science and medicine for us to work with an issue accurately and correctly to get the best help to people. So obesity is defined as a state of excessive fat accumulation in the body. And that accumulation of fat becomes bad for you, to put it simply. It has a lot of consequences. So when we categorize weight, we use this parameter called the body mass index. By and large, it is useful, but there's certain caveats in different ethnicities and people of different builds where you got to be a bit cautious about its use. And perhaps things like waist circumference or waist to height ratios may be more applicable. And a lot of research around that. But the idea is that the higher the body mass index, the higher your rate of complications. So overweight would be categorized as a BMI over 25. Obesity is 30 and above, then this class 1, 2, and 3 obesity up to 40, greater than which it's morbid obesity. Meaning if we don't deal with this, you're going to get some serious consequences soon. And we've got to work on it more aggressively. And the consequences of that are the big issue, you know, cardiovascular, cancer, mechanical issues, back pain, knee pains, osteoarthritis. So, and that causes a lot of what we call morbidity and mortality ultimately leads to death, you see.
Yeah.
You also got to include things like cardiovascular disease, stroke, diabetes. They all become, you become at high risk for those diseases when you're obese or when you have a high BMI, like Dr. Root is talking about now.
Yeah, I mean, there's also the reason I bring up the definitions is because a lot of this has now been obscured. It's no longer just the province of medical experts, because the definitions have now also become social. Mm-hmm. And there's an element of those social definitions which has been politically corrected, so that we now have people who say, well, I'm body positive, but they've got a BMI over 40, for example. And those people are in danger of a number of things that you've just listed.
Correct.
But we are supposed to just turn a blind eye, because society, not all of us are medically trained like you two are, society's led by the nose, so that we have to go, well, that's absolutely fine. It's okay if my sister or my aunt is just enormous and has no grip on her own health, but we must all pretend that it's absolutely fine. So I don't expect you to change that, you know. You can only inform.
That's the theme of World Obesity Day is let's talk about obesity and is to start these conversations. They're difficult conversations, but to actually start them,
yes,
it can affect policy change, that can turn words into action. I think that's the first point where we start is let's have the conversations. Let's be cross-collaborative. Dr. Ruda is more of an expert in this, and we'll listen to him.
So I think one of the things, Gareth, that the discussion around, and it's been debated for a couple of years now, is how to, or whether we should medicalize obesity as a disease. And there's a Lancet commission going on that at the moment. So if you medicalize a thing, there's an element of biological determinism in it. And there's a caution in this, there's a review in the Lancet on it, that perhaps the dilemma of human choice in things is something that will be sidelined. And it's not a judgment or anything on anyone. Ultimately, we are a species that have this dilemma of choice in everything we do. But on what basis we choose becomes the issue. And the environmental and social determinants of health are very important in that determination. But then there is that biological element. Once you've got established obesity, there's a lot of physiology that goes wrong that leads to disease. So if you medicalize that part, then these issues around a feeling of what obesity is can be objectively managed, you know, and say, look, this is a medical conundrum. And if you look into it without any feelings about it, then we have to do something about it. And that drives better treatments in the long term at the individual level. But then if you understand the social determinants as well, then we've got to work on that area as well in terms of food insecurity, the junk food marketing, et cetera, which is all very important as well. So you've got this individual at the center of everything with a positive energy balance. And the influences are macrocosmic and microcosmic, you see. And you've got to see it that way. Maybe one more point to make before we go on is that there's a tendency in medicine to look at disease based on our history of how we've developed medicine. Remember in the past, treatments were acute. You got a bacterial illness, the rise of antibiotics, you fix it immediately.
Sure.
Then there's trauma. We come out of an era of wars in the 1900s and 1800s. So trauma medicine is acute medicine. But in the modern times where there's a lot of technological advancement and life has changed, although there's a polarization of low and high socioeconomic status.
Sure.
The diseases we're seeing, we call them lifestyle diseases, non-communicable diseases, and the causation is protracted over a period of time. You cannot fix that overnight. So it requires a different way of thinking about it in the long term. You know, and I think that's important. Yeah.
So complex. You know, I think when you're dealing with a disease like cancer, yes, there are a lot of choices still that the human being can make going into that, for instance, lifestyles, not smoking, etc. But it almost feels like with obesity, there's even more. It's hormonal. It's your DNA. It's your stresses in life. It's whether you have money or not, you know, to whether McDonald's is going to be cheaper than buying roasted vegetable
That's
meal.
Right.
There's just so much that goes into it. It's so complex.
It is quite complex, but we have to try and see simple logic in things. And even that, you mentioned cancer, for example, it is now obesity is a risk factor for most of the common cancers we see. So breast, colon, kidney, endometrial cancer, right? So if we start educating the populace on this causation. See, obesity comes out of certain causes. Once you have obesity, it becomes the causal factor for other effects. So there's this law of life called cause and effect is playing out whether we like it or not.
Right.
You know? And we've got to examine that. If you look at cancer also, there's a flip side to the argument. Cancer cells grow in areas of constant damage to the body. We expose ourselves to the sun all the time, get damaged. That's where cancer will grow. The lungs, smoking all the time is damaged. It will grow there. So perhaps we need this philosophy. How is our body getting damaged in our current modern lifestyles? Perhaps there's a problem here also where science is a bit fragmented from how we use it to design life and policy. There's a separation. You see, ancients, and I am a bit of a philosopher on this aspect, which can lead to some disagreement, but it's a thought to consider that when people analyze nature, the laws of science, and what can go wrong, we would use that understanding to improve our relationship with the environment and nature. So in today's times, that would be policy, how we structure society, etc. We don't do that enough. It's almost like we will carry on in this trajectory of how we're living.
Yeah.
And something must fix it on the side. And I feel there's a discrepancy there that we need to infuse our learning into proper policy, you know.
And also, I mean, in South Africa, we have a very peculiar set of circumstances too. I mean, I've discussed with Dr. Patel diabetes and how important that is in taking South Africa into consideration as a whole. So we're a fat country.
Yeah.
We are.
We're probably amongst, I can't remember the rating currently, but I mean, the current numbers are looking at 68% female population obese and about 34% more or less. Correct me if I'm wrong.
It's a big difference.
Or male.
Are we being unfair if we just say, oh, well, women are more affected by this because it's just unlucky? What's the story? I mean, why is there such a discrepancy between male and female obesity in South Africa?
Isn't there a hormonal influence as well?
That's what Leanne was asking.
Difference of the sexes as well.
So there's a lot of research that is going on to try and investigate this. But there are some factors that are being identified. So certainly women tend to go through more hormonal changes during life. And those become vulnerable periods. We know during menopause, there's a general weight gain of about a kilo or two. Mm. But you see, you look at context matters. When you look at that change in an urban environment with our risk factors, the weight gain is much more than if you see someone who's living an active rural life, very natural kind of, you know, physical labor kind of life. That's one question. Risk factors like smoking, alcohol intake, high calorie foods, sedentariness all play a role in that context. So a given hormonal change, like pregnancy even, is a hormonal flux.
Mm-hmm.
And you will see patients in a high sort of obesogenic environment will put on more weight during pregnancy, which is more difficult to lose. So there may be some hormonal contribution, mild genetic contribution as well, but the context is the environment still. And the degree of weight gain then differs. There was one little study in Cape Town, I think it was UCT, a small study that showed women coming from rural areas of South Africa to the city where they get a tertiary education and take on work in corporate environments. Women tend to take on more sedentary jobs, office work,
mm-hmm.
whereas the men will come in more hard labor, you see? So there may be those kinds of differences too that lead to changes. And then, I mean, I read one small study where prolonged use of the oral contraceptive pill, for example, which a lot of women use for different reasons, may contribute to development of insulin resistance in the long term, which may contribute to a bit extra weight gain. So, and then last one, perhaps, Gareth, endocrine disrupting chemicals in the environment, hyperestrogenism and that sort of thing. This huge amount of research needs to be done there. They're everywhere, you know.
Yeah.
Mm.
So we got to think about these things. Yeah.
I find this fascinating stuff because there are also all those other complicating lifestyle factors, sleep,
stress.
The kind of food we eat, stress, exposure to, as you said, all the advertising and marketing and all of the stuff. We mustn't pretend it doesn't have an effect. So you've got a complex universe of things acting on the individual, and they also have choices, as you mentioned. Mm-hmm. And sometimes they make the wrong choices, but we can't just blame them for the wrong choices
mm-hmm.
in all of this, because there's so much other stuff that comes into play.
I think Sandeep can talk to this, but one of the biggest factors that has influenced this, especially in the field of diabetes, is urbanization. We spoke about this with Dr. Mamdu also when we did
the
podcast for One Heart Day.
Yeah.
It seems like urbanization was the catalyst for all of what we're experiencing now in terms of the situational and environmental factors that we're seeing influencing this.
Mm.
Yeah, I mean, that's what I mean when I say, you know, the science should try and direct policy in our design of society. Urbanization has just happened without us considering what the consequences would be. If you study some of ancient civilizations, I'm particularly fond of studying the East and the structure of society, the design of buildings, work, etc. was all designed around human being actualizing a purpose. And the purpose, everyone wants one thing. There's nothing wrong with that. It's peace, bliss, happiness.
Mm.
How we pursue that becomes the question. And in today's environment, it's become materialistic sense enjoyment, you see. So if we don't know a better way, then we become by default herd mentality. That's the slave mentality, isn't it? So Correct. Yeah, environmental change, but also developing human intellectual self-sufficiency that we can direct choices better. That combination, I think, is very, very important.
So what can ordinary people who are not necessarily, let's say you may be overweight, you may even be obese, you want to take charge of things and make your life a bit better, you don't want to put yourself at risk of heart disease and all the rest of it. Mm-hmm. How can you start, apart from the obvious of eat less and run more, which Dr. Mm-hmm. Patel I know is a supporter of. You love my diet, right?
I just wanted
you to do the forward for it so it could have some medical credibility. But
I love exercising, and I'm a huge fan and an advocate for exercising.
No, you are, and it's important to exercise, but what else can people do besides, you know, kind of moderate their intake of calories and do a bit of physical exercise so they're not sedentary the whole time?
And if we can add to that question, Ozempic.
Oh, yeah. You got to bring that up.
Mm-hmm. I have to know these
things. Has become a category name for a whole lot of drugs.
Yeah, I mean, it's just...
Because now people just say Ozempic, but they could mean one of 20 different kinds,
absolutely.
Right?
So let me start with the first part. That's okay, Fatima.
Sure. Please do.
Look, I think if you look at a series of studies, Bluer is one of the good researchers in obesity, a nice review in a high-impact journal, Nature Endocrine Reviews. The cause of obesity, it puts it in three categories. There's overeating, there's physical inactivity, and there's other. And the overeating, once again, and lack of physical activity, we're not judging people. That's not what we're saying. We've acclimatized to it. So under overeating, he puts a whole list. Social cultural phenomenon, starter, main dessert, after dinner mince, the business lunches. They've all been designed without a purpose. People eat when they're stressed, emotional, peer pressure. You know, there's so many reasons, wrong knowledge about what is the correct food. So yeah, all that has to be addressed. So we are in an overeating culture. So to eat a little bit better is not ideal. We've got to understand what is a normal diet. If you look at some of the reviews on the Khoisan diets, Hadza of Tanzania, the Bajau in the Philippines, what we're actually supposed to eat is very little. And that's why intermittent fasting and these things today are considered fads and extremism. You know, we're not going to starve, but to change to a different climate requires a perception and a paradigm shift. So that's the one thing on eating. Physical activity, action is the insignia of life. There's the concept of disuse atrophy. What we don't use in nature becomes stagnant and putrid. So you look at that documentary on Netflix, the Blue Zone. Those people were active. They did everything manually. Now, we got to try and replicate that in urban environments to some degree. Then there's the other part, abnormal sleep cycle. Thermogenesis is some studies showing that because we don't get cold in winter anymore because we've got heaters around, we don't activate enough
We're
brown
not
fat.
Burning the fat into...
Yeah.
Into
there actually is else. Brown fat between the scapula.
Oh, and
the
brown back. Fat sounds horrible. Really.
Well, you want more of it because it burns the bad fat, right?
Yeah.
So that cold exposure, you know, so there's many other reasons. There's neuroendocrine factors where the thermostat for weight and appetite control gets set lower for some reason. And that's where these new drugs are useful. So I think, like we said earlier, it's very complex, but you've got to address all of these things. Now, if you don't understand complexity and you want instant gratification, then you want a drug now to fix it. Now, there have been the advent of very useful medications in the treatment of obesity, and that particular class, one of them is the GLP-1 receptor agonist. These are hormones of the gut-brain axis, which when used appropriately can help reset those thermostats and do give obese patients a good advantage to start losing weight along with lifestyle changes. Now, the particular drug you mentioned belongs to that class, but that one was first studied for diabetes and the weight loss was a minor side effect. I would say that that drug, semaglutide, is useful in diabetics and it's life-saving in some of them. It showed cardiovascular risk reduction. A spin-off of that was study of the same drug at a higher dose for obesity, which is not available in this country at the moment. And a shortage of that drug abroad led to the awareness of semaglutide 1 milligram, and a shortage of that now that actually some of our diabetic patients are completely deprived of it.
Because of Hollywood elites that are busy injecting themselves.
You see, and that's the thing. So that's why I think to medicalize an aspect of it is important, because you want to get bang for buck here in terms of a medical benefit. And remember, all drugs have side effects. There are other drugs also that work more centrally, like naltrexone, bupropion, or the craving center, etc. So when you're using drugs, you got to weigh benefits and risks and individualize the approach to a patient where some buy-in to a holistic process. And you use the drugs like a pole vault. Yeah. My approach in the long term is, see, you want to use the pole vault to get to the high bar to cross it. That's your success. But you need to learn to use this pole appropriately. Otherwise, you're going to fall, right? Okay. And once you get to the bar, you have to let it go to achieve your success, isn't it?
Right.
So if you think of that analogy like that, we can work with patients long-term. My patients, 2-3 years sometimes. I know there's a drive to want to use these drugs chronically, like you would a statin for cholesterol. I think it's too early to say that. There are advancements in it also happening. But side effect-wise, I would also be a bit cautious. A lot of gastric side effects. We can't say we've put the thyroid side effects to bed yet. Mm. You know, they're a small issue. The current thyroid side effects in terms of risk of thyroid cancer don't mandate us to not use the drug. The benefits still far outweigh the risk. But, you know, when you use things long-term and it's more prevalent in use in the real world, that's when things start popping up. So while they are good treatments, I think we have to use it appropriately.
Yeah, it's so easy to get caught in that trap of taking your 6-month script and just refilling it until eventually 10, 15 years have passed and you haven't had anything reassessed. I'm on thyroid medication. I haven't had that reassessed in 8 years. I'm just taking the medication.
Yeah, Leanne, you should have that assessment.
Yeah, exactly. I was very careful.
She can't even see through her glasses this morning. She's a woman with many problems.
We're starting with sight so that I can drive to the doctors.
You should see the stuff that they added to her bill. I mean, it's like stuff here that I think that they're just taking the piss. There's one there that says, at the bottom.
What scan? A fundus scan?
No, that's that we figured out.
Yeah, we figured that out.
That's your eye examination.
Yeah. It doesn't matter.
So we're starting somewhere. And I think the best successes I've had in the past with weight control have been with endocrinologists. Mm-hmm. I believe that that's the way to go, especially when you're dealing with things like insulin resistance, which I have. The dangling of the Ozempic carrot in front of everyone.
People are desperate for a cure-all. I mean, they've been talking about the pill that you could pop or the injection you could get one day.
There's always
something. They're
always
weight.
Looking for the silver always. Bullet.
And I mean, wouldn't the pharmaceutical companies love to have that silver bullet? Because they could sell it at whatever price they wanted.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of money to be made in the field. So you got to be cautious of that too.
Sure.
I would say that by and large, a lot of the use of obesity medications has been outside of the obesity space. So people are getting these drugs without prescription in some instances. Mm. There have been a lot of issues where fake versions of it are appearing and you have to be cautious. And it's in the space of cosmetics and vanity.
That's it.
I need to lose weight for a wedding. So that's where you're seeing a lot of use as well. What we're sitting here and talking about is obesity as a medical problem, you see, and appropriate identification of those patients. And then selective drug use where appropriate. That's important, I think.
I think ultimately it comes down to a multifactorial approach. It's not just one thing. It's many things that are contributing to what we're seeing now in this epidemic. And medical is one of the issues that has to be addressed for a patient.
Sure, but I do again think that there's quite a lot of this that is about the person making choices and being responsible for themselves. You know, there are obviously things that are beyond everybody's control. Environmental circumstances, there may be genetic components of this as well. Could be all kinds of things, but ultimately the one thing you can do something about is decide to do something about it.
Yeah, that choice exists for all of us. The degree to which we can make those choices in a better way depends on certain fundamental values also, Gareth, which we don't talk about. If you read Confucius and Buddha, you know, extract philosophies, forget the character and personality, but the eternal truths of duties over rights, gratitude, unselfishness. You know, if those sorts of fundamental values are considered in our choices, I think a lot of things aside from obesity can change. And that's what we don't think about. There's the other side of society, unfortunately, and I've worked in some of the rural areas of South Africa where it really is difficult to bear sometimes, where people on traditional diets and subsistence farming had access to healthy, nutritious food, high protein sources from animals, eggs, and the vegetation they grew in Limpopo, in Venda, etc. But now, because of the food systems changing and the structure of society changing, I mean, you're getting shocked. You know, the food that we ought to be eating has become niche. Organic veggies you get at a shop in Bryanston at a high cost.
Yeah, farmers
is what
market.
They were growing, you know. So that food security issue, especially with the poor and marginalized, a loaf of bread and a 2-liter Coke with acha is not food. It's not nutritious, you know. I think that needs to be addressed. And you look at guys like Healthy Living Alliance and priceless Professor Karen Hoffman's work. I think we should try and support those sorts of things, you know. South Africa is a place where it could be a microcosm of new things that can be born, but there's a tendency just to copy-paste, especially in medicine, how Western paradigms go, especially America. And
America's got no room to talk about this stuff.
No.
Because, I mean, they're a very fat country too, right?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. I think that's very interesting. Yeah, I mean, there are lots of questions here. Someone wants to know about intermittent fasting because according to JP, he heard you say that you shouldn't attempt it, but you're actually saying you think it's fine. We eat too much.
Yeah, I mean, it depends how you look at intermittent fasting. And once again, with everything, context matters. In a certain vulnerable group, you're not going to suddenly do intermittent fasting, pregnant woman or someone who has other issues. But if you have a philosophy of minimizing your caloric intake, I mean, I'm 46 years old now. I you could say my lifestyle is intermittent fasting. I don't have the desire to eat 3 meals a day. You know, 2 simple meals, very nutritious. I enjoy my food. And that's enough to maintain my body. You have that philosophy. Now, you could do intermittent fasting in terms of a time-restricted or a day-restricted. These are medical ways of doing things. The studies, there have been studies that have shown you can get weight loss, you can improve diabetes markers. In some case, look, if you catch type 2 diabetes in obese patients early, 15% weight loss and maintenance of that weight loss has been shown to put it into remission, you know.
Yeah.
So we can achieve those things through lifestyle interventions. Intermittent fasting has benefits in improving longevity, reducing cancer risk. And there's some data on Parkinson's and Alzheimer's.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
So
even
those sorts of diseases can
there's
improve.
There's a link with Alzheimer's being, there was a discussion I remember some years ago about calling it a type 3 diabetes. You know? We're seeing a lot of dementia in people who consume highly refined sugars and high calories in their life. Guys with a sweet tooth.
Sugar.
So there's a lot of causation here that I think will come to the fore in years to come.
So a couple of quick questions from the comments section here. So we've got someone who says, what about carnivore diets? You want to address that one?
Dr. Ruder, I'll leave that
in
your
I don't know
your
much
experts.
About the carnivore diet.
Okay.
But I mean, look, I mean, I've probably just read it in passing as people just eating really meat and avoiding veggies and that sort of thing. 175 country, 20-year study showed that the healthiest diets on earth were cultures imbibed vegetables, vegetarian diets are healthiest. Then you get the Mediterranean type of diet where it's lots of veggies, chicken, oily fish like tuna, salmon, that sort of thing. As you start getting to the red meat level, the health outcomes are a little worse. And once you add processed meat, it's terrible. So processed meat, definite no-no. So I think a sense of proportion is very important.
I think it also comes down to the individual. It's not a one diet fits all for everyone. It has to come down to that person, has to be assessed medically, clinically, their environment, how their work sustains their diets, their lifestyle. It has to be assessed holistically and individualized. It's not a one fits all.
So here's an easy question from Carl. He says, do cold plunges really kill fat?
they'll kill you if you're not careful.
Thank you.
Don't tell that to Ben.
Well, first thing on a winter's morning, I don't think that's great. Yeah.
Yeah. Look, I mean, those sorts of, I know what he's talking about. I can't remember the chap's name, the Iceman guy, right?
Yes.
Look, I mean, these sorts of interventions, I study a lot of history. You imagine an ancient sage waking up in his hut, very knowledgeable, takes a dip in the ice-cold Ganges, exposes himself to the sun in the morning, and then gets about his daily business. He's living within circadian rhythm. And there is evidence that cold exposure at certain times can reset a lot of our circadian clock. Whether it directly burns fat is a different issue. But you see, we tend to think about things myopically like that. Well, this burn fat. No, yeah. Maybe if it's part of a good rhythm of life, then you're okay, you know. And certain circadian clocks is a big issue in endocrinology right now. Every cell in the body has been identified to have a genetic clock, which is in keeping with the timing of the sun cycle. So the human beings today, when we choose to do what we like, how we like it, and avoid what we dislike, we tend to burn the midnight oil and work into sleep later, isn't it? Mm. So that's against this clock. And the studies are very clear that that disturbance of clocks leads to a lot of metabolic disease, including lipogenesis, which is fat formation, you know.
Well, I think, unfortunately, that's all we got time for. But this is a fascinating subject. And I do think we've just started scratching the surface. But it's, I mean, there's so much to talk about here, right? And people are dealing with this on a day-to-day basis. Mm. Whether you're old, young, rich, poor.
Yeah.
It doesn't seem to make much difference. Everybody has their own battle against obesity.
I'm just glad that I can now say I'm not overweight or obese. I'm just going through lipogenesis. Sounds much fancier.
But that's the point of what obesity day is, to start these conversations.
Yeah.
That's where it all starts, and to, through platforms like this, broadcasting. And
not to be afraid to talk about it. Because also there's this thing that's crept in now where people are afraid to even have the discussion.
Yeah.
You know, the last thing you want to do is have someone sit next to you on a plane and they're enormous and now you're just desperate that they don't talk to you or you don't talk to them. Frightens the hell out of me. Mm-hmm. Like, what's she going to do when the meal comes? What's she going to do?
Yeah, you should have your own private jet.
What's she going to do? I should, right? That's a big travesty of justice that I don't have my own private jet. All right. Well, listen, I mean, this has been terrific. Thank you so much, Dr. Sandeep Ruda. It's very nice to meet you. And I love the philosophy angle here.
I got a gift for you, some books.
Oh, more books to read. I'm being your books.
No.
Oh, okay. Well, I'm excited. I'll be sure to share these with the audience. And thank you, Dr. Fatima Patel.
Pleasure,
it's always nice to see you.
Always good to be here.
Yeah, this is good. So we got lots to think about, everybody, on Obesity Day. World Obesity Day. And you can find out more, head over to cliffcentral.com, and we've got plenty of other content that you'd be interested in. CliffCentral.com.